This edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Magazine, followed by Travelin' Texas at 4.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 54 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
If it's in Texas, it's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Gove, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on site and sound broadcasting. Our first article will be from the January issue we just started last week, and this is one of the feature articles. It's entitled Presumed Guilty. It's by Michael Hall. Lydell Grant spent almost 10 years behind bars for a brutal murder he didn't commit. DNA evidence has proven his innocence, and Houston's top cop has apologized for his wrongful conviction. So why won't the state's highest criminal court exonerate him? In his darkest hours, Lydell Grant would think back to the promise he'd made to his mother. Ever since arriving at the Hughes Unit, a maximum security prison in Gatesville, just west of Waco, Grant had developed fanatical work habits. He rose each morning at 3 a.m. and did 300 push-ups and 150 sit-ups. By 5:30, he was bent over a desk in a law library. He became a student of the U.S. Constitution and the Texas Criminal Code. He sent dozens of letters to defense lawyers, though most went unanswered. He filed at least 8 motions and appeals to various courts. Nearly all were turned down. 1 year stretched to 2 to 3. Before he knew it, almost 7 years had passed. He was determined to prove he didn't belong behind bars. The more Grant learned, though, the more he realized how difficult that task was going to be. According to a 2006 opinion delivered by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the state's highest criminal tribunal, demonstrating that you are actually innocent is a Herculean endeavor. Grant would need to gather clear and convincing new evidence to overturn the jury verdict against him. That would mean somehow overcoming the testimony of a half dozen eyewitnesses who claimed they had watched him viciously stab a man to death outside a Houston nightclub in 2010. DNA evidence was one avenue. A confession from the real killer was another. Sitting in his 8x12-foot cell late at night, Grant felt neither possibility was likely. And things seemed especially bleak. He would recall the brief moments after his sentencing. As the bailiff slapped on the handcuffs, Grant turned and looked at his mom, who had tears in her eyes. She knew he'd made a terrible mistakes in the past, but he paid for them. This was different. Far worse. He was going away for the rest of his life for a murder he did not commit. "Don't worry, Mama," he said as calmly as he could. "I'll be back." It was a balmy December evening in Houston, and 4 men, 3 bouncers, and a bartender's assistant were enjoying a brief lull outside Club Blur. The door was closed, but they could hear the pulsing throb of dance music inside. Club Blur sat at the corner of Crocker and Pacific Streets in the Montrose District, center of Houston's gay cultural life. It had been a typical busy evening. Boisterous crowds thronged the streets. At around 11:45 p.m., though, the 4 heard something out of place, a voice screaming in desperation. "Help!" someone cried. "Someone help me." The cries grew louder, and within moments, a stocky man with short dark hair sprinted toward the group. "Help me," he screamed. "He's trying to kill me." The man's name, they would later learn, was Aaron Shearhorn. He ducked behind the bouncers and tried to open the door, which one of the men blocked. Breathing heavily, Shearhorn opened his jacket to reveal his blood-soaked shirt. At that moment, a second man came charging up to the group. He paused, pulled out a knife with a 3 or 4 inch blade and began waving it menacingly. He lurched at Shearhorn. Club Blur employees scattered, and Shearhorn fled into the club's parking lot, where his pursuer caught him and stabbed him repeatedly. When Shearhorn finally collapsed, the attacker folded up the knife, slipped it into his pocket, and calmly walked away. Shearhorn, who had been stabbed at least 7 times, died soon after. He was 28. There was no shortage of witnesses. When police officers arrived, they interviewed the bouncers, the barback, and several others, including a passerby on the street and 2 patrons of the club who had watched in horror from the second-floor patio as the savage attack played out below. The whole thing had happened quickly, in just a few minutes. The eyewitness accounts shared in common only a few vague descriptive details of the assailant. He was a black man with short hair who stood between 6 foot and 6 foot 7 inches tall and had an average or muscular build between 200 and 230 pounds. The police were still seeking a suspect as the sun rose the next morning, December 11th, 2010. Brutal killing could be crime of passion, read the headline in that day's Houston Chronicle. Getting the name could make or break the case, Houston Police Detective Sergeant Eli Cisneros told the paper. You could have numerous witnesses, but if you don't have a name, you have nothing. Cisneros didn't have to wait long. The night after the attack, the barback was once again standing outside Club Blur when he spotted a tall, muscular black man with short hair stepping out of a white Pontiac Grand Prix after parking in front of the bar. The man walked down the street to a different club, and the barback jotted down the car's license plate number. He dialed Crime Stoppers. The tip was relayed to the Houston Police Department and passed to Cisneros, who looked up the car's owner when he got to the office the following morning. Now Cisneros had a name. Lydell Grant, 33, had a lengthy rap sheet, so detectives were able to pull a photograph of him. They created a photo spread, putting one of Grant's mugshots in a lineup alongside photos of five other young black men. That morning, Cisneros set out to visit the eyewitnesses, beginning with the barback. By day's end, six eyewitnesses, an extraordinary number for a violent crime, had picked out Grant as Sheerhorn's killer. It was less than 48 hours since the stabbing, and Cisneros had what appeared to be an open and shut case. From the moment Grant was arrested for Sheerhorn's murder, he wondered if he'd angered God somehow. He was being punished. Maybe, he thought, God was trying to tell him something, or save him. Grant grew up in the Windsor Village neighborhood of the Hiring Clark area of southwest Houston, a working-class community with brick homes. It was also known as a center of gang activity. Vince Young, who would become a star quarterback at the University of Texas, was raised in the Clark several years after Lydell and attributed his toughness to growing up there. Lydell's mother, Donna, never married his father, but in 1979, when Lydell was two, she wed Zachary Poe, an operator at a shell manufacturing plant and a deacon at the New South Main Baptist Church. Grant was the middle child of five, a quiet, skinny, tidy kid whose nickname was Dello. He gravitated to music at a young age, especially hip-hop by artists such as Public Enemy and LL Cool J. He and his siblings sang in a choir at Poe's church. Grant and Alonzo Poe, his younger half-brother by a year, did everything together. Their father would make them perform maintenance on the church, mow the yards of elderly neighbors, and distribute a community newsletter. At age eight, Alonzo became an entrepreneur, starting his own landscaping business. 5 years later, he learned how to hang sheetrock and landed gigs with local contractors. He'd always enlist Lydell to assist in whatever he had going. Around middle school, though, Lydell started hanging out with troublemakers, getting into fights, smoking weed, and engaging in petty theft, Air Jordans, Guess jeans. His mother, who worked as a desk agent at a Hilton hotel after years driving a school bus, would often chide him. "You're going to have to straighten yourself out," she would say. He ignored her. When Grant was 16, he walked into a local dry cleaner with a friend who was 3 years older. Grant would later insist he had no idea his friend was going to rob the place, or that he was carrying a pistol, which he pulled on employees and customers before taking their money. Both teens fled and were caught. Grant's mother was devastated. The lawyer convinced him to plead guilty and accept 10 years in prison to avoid a sentence that could have been much longer. "I didn't know no better," Grant later said. Grant was kept in Harris County custody until he turned 18 and then was sent to prison. He spent his time lifting weights, playing basketball and boxing. He was no longer a skinny kid, and he'd joined a gang. In his cell, Grant passed time writing raps about his life, dreaming of a career behind the mic. After serving his full sentence, Grant was released in 2004. He found work alongside his brother Alonzo and his cousins as a pipe fitter at various refineries near the Houston Chip Chain. He also began performing under the name Dello Daru Dude and hanging out with members of the Screwed Up Clique, a loose collective of Houston rappers led by the late DJ Screw, who was famed for slowing down raps and putting them on cassette tapes. Screwed style was wildly popular in Houston and across the South. Grant also joined the Balletitians, a hip-hop group that enjoyed mild success. One of the outfit's songs, "Get Money Over Here," was played on the local hip-hop station 97.9 The Box, and a music video of the song was shown on Street Flava, a local Saturday night TV show. "You don't understand how I'm living my life," Grant rapped. "No marriage papers, no rings. I ain't safe for no wife." Grant was still living a life of crime. Got busted for possession of marijuana and stealing credit cards. Stints behind bars became part of a cycle. He'd get caught, serve time, get out, get caught again. All the while, he continued writing about his experiences, and he kept rapping. He developed a reputation as a charismatic performer, He could command a stage, says his cousin, Kalani Anthony, and he toured the state, doing shows in Austin, Corpus Christi, and Dallas. His mother was proud. He was doing so good with his music, Donna remembers. Grant felt as if he was on the cusp of something big. I was moving up in the scene, level by level, he says. But it all came to an end on December 15th, 2010, when he was arrested for the vicious murder at Club Blur. We have six eyewitnesses that can positively identify you as the killer of Aaron Shearhorn, Grant remembers the detective telling him. I don't care if you have 600 witnesses, he responded. I didn't kill him. Alonzo believed him. Grant's little brother hired and paid a veteran attorney. The man died of cancer a year later before Grant's case went to trial. Grant was appointed a second lawyer from the Harris County Public Defender's Office, but he also got sick with cancer and had to withdraw. Grant was then appointed another attorney. He was confident he would be found not guilty. He had an alibi, plus there was no physical evidence tying him to the crime, which was odd given the violent nature of the attack. On the first day of trial, December 3rd, 2012, as Grant sat at the defense table wearing a new gray suit, one of the prosecutors even admitted in an opening statement to the jury, I don't expect that we'll be able to prove motive to you. Didn't wait long to trot out their strongest evidence. A few things sway a jury like a confident eyewitness, literally pointing out a suspect inside the courtroom. And in Grant's case, the district attorney had six eyewitnesses who testified with a high degree of certainty that Grant had stabbed Shearhorn, even though the attack had taken place at night. Three said they were positive, two were 100% sure, and another was very sure. Grant's face was burned into my memory immediately, said one witness who had seen the murder from the second floor club patio, roughly 20 feet above the attack. The state then brought forward DNA evidence. An analyst from the Houston Police Department's crime lab had found DNA profiles for two people beneath Shearhorn's fingernails, though she could only find a full profile for one of them. It belonged, she said, to Aaron Shearhorn. When the analyst talked about the other profile, jurors were given muddled information. She testified that she couldn't exclude Grant, implying that Grant's DNA was potentially under Shearhorn's fingernails. Grant's lawyer, who hadn't hired a DNA expert, didn't object, though he did get the analyst to affirm that she couldn't associate Grant with the DNA mixture. Grant's lawyers only called one witness. A man named Raul Rodriguez testified that on the night of December 10th, he and Grant had struck up a conversation in the parking lot of a different Montrose bar. They'd gone bar hopping together. They never stopped into Club Blur and later wound up in Rodriguez's hotel room where they stayed until morning. After 3 days of testimony, the jury retired mid-morning of day four. They didn't deliberate for long, returning before lunch. Grant stood in shock as he heard the verdict and then later the sentence. As officers prepared to take him away, he gave his mother his promise. Even before he was convicted, when he was in the Harris County Jail awaiting trial, Grant had begun visiting the law library as often as he was allowed. He filed a motion asking the judge to give him more time due to the severity of the charge alleged. The judge denied the request. He and Alonzo talked frequently. Alonzo would drive to the state law library in Austin to photocopy documents from cases that were similar to Grant's. Shortly after Grant was convicted, he penned a letter. Dear reader, he began, I was falsely accused, arrested, charged, confined, indicted, and wrongfully convicted. What is scary is how tenaciously police and prosecutors cling to their initial assumptions and how much this reflects basic human tendency. He and Alonzo, his most fervent ally, sent copies of the letter to dozens of lawyers, including those of the Innocence Project in New York City and the Innocence Project of Texas based in Fort Worth. They mailed them to celebrities such as Oprah Winfrey and the radio host Tom Joyner, the local radio stations, including Houston's 97.9 The Box, and to various churches. Few bothered to respond. Alonzo visited his brother every week at the Hughes Unit, and the two would discuss legal strategy. One day in the law library, Grant met another inmate who suggested that he request the police reports on the stabbing. Grant did, along with the 9 volumes of trial transcripts, which he stored in a large box at the foot of his cot. He read them over and over, looking for inconsistencies in testimony, anything he might be able to raise on appeal. His library friend read the transcripts and told Grant that the DNA results that had seemed so confusing at trial were actually favorable to him. In fact, the analyst's report clearly stated, no conclusions will be made regarding Lydell Grant as a possible contributor. The man encouraged Grant to get an independent lab to analyze the results. Grant collected a variety of legal documents, including the 36th edition of the Georgetown Law Journal's Annual Review of Criminal Procedure. He read Scott Turow's novel, Presumed Innocence, which was made into a movie starring Harrison Ford about a man wrongly tried for murder. Grant committed himself to improving his vocabulary, learning 5 new words a week, which he would try to incorporate into his letters and motions. He wrote every day, but now it wasn't rap lyrics, it was motions and appeals. He spent hours revising his prose. His handwriting was precise, stylized. Unlike during his first stint in prison, Grant only hung out with friends from the prison church and those who were researching their cases, dreaming of returning home. Other inmates began to come to him for legal advice. When his mother, Donna, visited, she could see how committed he was, how high his spirits were. That was the only thing that kept me at peace, she remembers. Grant was appointed an attorney to help file the appeal, but after 6 months, the inmate protested to the court that the lawyer has not cooperated nor corresponded with him. Grant asked for permission to file the appeal on his own. The lawyer did finally file an appeal, but in 2014, and it was turned down. The next year, Grant was transferred to the Michael Unit in Tennessee Colony near Palestine. After studying the U.S. Constitution's Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel, Grant filed a motion for a lawyer to help him with a writ of habeas corpus, which is used to challenge the fundamental fairness of a conviction. Grant alleged that his trial lawyer had failed to interview eyewitnesses, never objected to hearsay testimony during trial, and neglected to hire a DNA expert. Grant was convinced that all he needed was a committed attorney. He petitioned for a court-appointed lawyer to help him get post-conviction DNA testing to retest the DNA mixture, and was appointed representation in 2016. When the lawyer wrote to him that he was unsure of how DNA could help you, Grant became outraged and demanded another attorney. In January 2018, he was assigned Brittany Lacayo, who filed a motion for DNA testing. Grant believed it was just a matter of time. By that point, one of his letters had reached the desk of Mike Ware, the executive director of the Innocence Project of Texas, a nonprofit group that was helping exonerate 27 wrongly convicted Texans since launching in 2006. The organization receives thousands of letters a year from inmates, many of which are vetted by law students. Ware teaches at Texas A&M School of Law in Fort Worth, and once he read Grant's letter in which he swore he was innocent and said he had been convicted on mistaken eyewitness testimony, professor assigned it to one of the students in his actual innocence clinic. Ware, 66, is one of the most experienced innocence lawyers in the country. He has had a hand in some 36 exonerations, both with IPTX, he became its leader in 2016, and with the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, where from 2007 to 2011, he led a conviction integrity unit that oversaw 25 investigations of wrongful convictions. In class, the drawling, shaggy-haired attorney taught that, according to multiple studies, mistaken eyewitness identification was the number one cause of wrongful convictions. We like to think of our brains as a video camera, recording our experiences and filing them away, but memory doesn't work like that. It's mutable, prone to error. What's more, experiments have shown over and over that people of one race have major problems identifying individuals of another race, a factor in some 2/5 of all DNA-based exonerations. Of the 6 eyewitnesses in Grant's case, 1 was black, 2 were Latino, 2 white, and 1 Asian American. Ware explained to his students that investigators using a photo spread can inadvertently steer witnesses toward a particular person in the lineup by, say, commenting on a certain photo or by smiling or nodding when a witness looks at a particular face. Analysts have also found that showing multiple photos simultaneously can lead witnesses to pick someone merely because that person looks more like the suspect than anyone else in the panel. In 2011, after lobbying by IPTX, the Texas legislature passed a law that changed how law enforcement conducted lineups. It called for the adoption of a standardized methodology that included double-blind lineups, in which the officer administering a lineup can't know who the suspect is and therefore is unable to tip off the eyewitnesses. Of course, this still leaves plenty of room for error, but it represented a vast improvement. Unfortunately for Grant, whose lineup was conducted in 2010, those new rules were no help. The student Ware assigned to Grant's case spotted multiple red flags with his conviction, and after a class discussion, the professor agreed with the student's assessment. Ware wasn't intimidated by a large number of witnesses either. He knew there was a precedent for multiple witnesses to be mistaken. In 1984, 5 rape victims identified Thomas Hainsworth as their attacker in Richmond, Virginia. He was convicted and spent 27 years in prison before being exonerated by DNA evidence in 2011. In 1985, 5 eyewitnesses in Rosedale, Maryland testified that they had seen a man named Kirk Bloodsworth with a young girl who was later found raped and murdered. Bloodsworth was convicted but later exonerated by DNA. It wasn't just the eyewitness testimony that troubled Ware. He had seen hundreds of DNA tests in his career, and when he looked at the data from Shearhorn's murder, he noticed numerous alleles, the repeating genetic variations that make up a profile that didn't belong to either the victim or to Grant. He read the trial transcript and saw that the analyst implied Grant's profile could have been in the mixture. In early 2019, Ware contacted Lacayo, the lawyer appointed by the court to file for DNA testing, and offered to help as pro bono counsel. He also consulted with Angie Ambers, a forensic DNA analyst and professor at the University of New Haven in Connecticut, who converted the data from the original test and punched it into an Excel spreadsheet. What she saw was remarkable. 26 alleles that didn't belong to either Grant or Shearhorn. It was pretty straightforward, she says. Obviously, someone else's DNA was there. Grant's DNA, she told Ware, was clearly not present in the mixture. She suggested to Ware that he confirm her analysis using a new software-based method of analyzing DNA mixtures called probabilistic genotyping, which employs high-powered computers and is capable of interpreting mixtures by intricately unraveling all of the parts. In March 2019, Ware sent the raw data to Cyber Genetics Corporation in Pittsburgh. The lab's report not only conclusively excluded Grant, it discerned a second profile, which was then uploaded into the FBI's national database of roughly 14 million convicted criminals. In June, the database got a hit. The DNA profile belonged to a man named Jermerico Carter, who had an extensive criminal history in Houston, but had moved to Atlanta a few months after the murder. Carter was black and around the same height and weight as Grant, though the two men bore little resemblance. He and Grant were even born on the same day, 1 year apart. Carter had recently been arrested in Atlanta on a parole violation, and when he was interviewed by Houston cops, he initially denied the murder. However, when confronted with the DNA evidence, he confessed on videotape to having had an altercation with Shearhorn. He admitted to chasing Shearhorn toward the bar while carrying a knife, but he claimed he only punched him. In October, Grant's lawyers filed a writ of habeas corpus, asserting that he was actually innocent, a special legal claim that can be used by convicted persons to categorically prove they did not commit an offense. The lawyers wrote that they had developed new DNA evidence implicating another man and that the DNA analyst at trial had given inaccurate testimony that violated Grant's due process rights. Ware delivered the DNA results to the Harris County District Attorney's Office, which then asked the Houston Police Department to reinvestigate the crime. Officers could find no links between Grant and Shearhorn, but they found that Carter had indeed lived in Houston in 2010. He'd previously been arrested in the Montrose area, and he'd also been accused of stabbing someone in Atlanta 4 months after Shearhorn was killed. Things moved quickly after that. Just before Thanksgiving, with the DA's endorsement, Grant was released on a $100,000 bond while the police and the DA's Conviction Integrity Division continued their investigation. Grant walked out of the Harris County Jail to a crowd of family members. As he addressed the throng of media, he was flanked by his mother and Alonzo. "What's the lesson here?" someone asked. "Never give up," Donna responded, aiming at her son, who had been behind bars for almost a decade on this conviction. "You can't," Grant said, shaking his head. "You can't. You can't. If you know for a fact that you are innocent of any crime that you're alleged to have committed, the thing is, never give up and trust in God." The police concluded their investigation. Just before Christmas, the DA's office dropped the case against Grant and charged Carter with murder. "We will begin the exoneration process for Lydell Grant immediately," said District Attorney Kim Ogg. That same day, Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo released a remarkable statement. "On behalf of the Houston Police Department, I want to extend an apology to Mr. Grant and his family as they have waited for justice all these years." A week later, trial judge George Powell ruled on the habeas appeal. Grant had proved he was actually innocent. It was as if the whole Houston legal community was coming together to correct a terrible injustice. Now all Grant had to do was persuade the High Court in Austin, Court of Criminal Appeals. The stakes couldn't be higher. Not only would an actual innocence verdict wipe out the murder conviction off his record, he would be eligible for $80,000 a year in compensation for every year he'd spent behind bars for his wrongful conviction, plus subsidized health insurance. It wouldn't make up for what happened, Grant thought, but it was a start. Most states have one court of final resort. Texas has two. The Texas Supreme Court handles the appeals of civil cases. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, or CCA, takes care of criminal cases. The CCA has 9 members, and like all other state courts, it's an elected body, so its philosophical makeup shifts over time. This can have dramatic consequences for those whose cases are considered by the court. Since 1998, every judge elected has been a Republican. Seven members of the current court are former prosecutors, and many have brought to the bench a skepticism toward criminal defendants and their advocates. It hasn't always been that way. The CCA was composed entirely of Democrats in the early 90s and had a reputation for overturning convictions based on technicalities. In 1996, the court made a historic ruling that would empower convicts like never before. Joe Elizondo had been convicted in Port Arthur in 1984 of sexually assaulting his stepson. Years later, the young man recanted his testimony, and Elizondo filed a writ of habeas corpus, claiming that he was innocent based on his new evidence. The trial court threw out his conviction, and the CCA, in a decision written by former defense lawyer Larry Myers, not only upheld the ruling, but wrote that claims of actual innocence are cognizable by this court. The ruling made Texas one of the first states in the country to allow inmates to overturn their convictions based on new evidence of their actual innocence. Up until that point, an inmate's writ of habeas had to be based on a broad constitutional problem. The courts wouldn't hear a claim of actual innocence, even if the inmate was slated for execution, unless he could demonstrate he had been denied due process of law. As the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia famously wrote in 2009, this court has never held that the Constitution forbids the execution of a convicted defendant who has had a full and fair trial but is later able to convince a habeas court that he is actually innocent. Although the Elizondo precedent was historic, it didn't lead to a surge in exonerations. That's because claiming actual innocence is one thing, establishing it is another matter entirely. To definitely prove that a person didn't do something is like proving a negative. Absent a video of someone else committing the crime, it borders on impossible. The standard set by the CCA, the convict must unearth new evidence that is so clear and convincing that no reasonable juror would have convicted him in light of it. This is a very high bar, and the convict first has to convince the judge in the trial court where the habeas writ is filed, and then that judge's ruling must be affirmed by a majority of the CCA. Usually the CCA accepts the decision of the trial judge, but not always. Not even with seemingly conclusive DNA evidence. One of the more infamous examples of this was a 1998 decision involving Roy Kreiner, a resident of New Caney, just north of Houston. Kreiner had been convicted in 1990 of the rape and murder of a teenage girl, mostly based on the testimony of three friends who said he'd bragged about forcing a hitchhiker to have sex with him. Kreiner was sentenced to 99 years in prison. In 1997, however, DNA testing demonstrated that the semen found in the victim was not his. A trial judge ordered a new trial, but 4 months later, the CCA overruled that decision. Judge Sharon Keller wrote, "The new evidence does not establish innocence." Keller had been on the court for 3 years by then. Before that, she'd spent 7 years working in the appellate division of the Dallas County DA's office. In 1994, when Keller ran for election to the CCA at age 41, she described herself as pro-prosecutor. What that meant, she said, in a bracing admission of bias was seeing legal issues from the perspective of the state instead of the perspective of the defense. She won handily, and though the bar for proving actual innocence was already high, she soon made it clear that she'd like to raise it still higher. Even fellow conservatives didn't always agree with her. Then Governor George W. Bush, for example, eventually pardoned Kreiner in 2000, 2 years after the CCA declined to free him based on the new DNA evidence. That same year, Keller became presiding judge, and she sought to steadily move the court in a more pro-prosecutor direction. On occasion, rulings against defendants and inmates were outright abrasive. Perhaps the most notorious example came from Keller herself on September 25, 2007. Around 4:45 p.m., lawyers representing death row inmate Michael Richard petitioned for an extra 30 minutes to file a last-second writ. "We close at 5," Keller responded, denying the appeal and dooming Richard to die hours later. The decision was met with outrage, and the state's Commission on Judicial Conduct launched an investigation. The New York Times called for her removal in an editorial, pointing to her fundamental misunderstanding of justice. Keller wasn't going anywhere. The CJC gave her a public warning, which a special review court later dismissed. And in 2015, she found an active ally in what many court watchers perceived to be a crusade against inmates who had proved their actual innocence. That was the year Kevin Yeary, then 49, came onto the court. Yeary, who grew up in Laredo and attended college and law school at St. Mary's University in San Antonio, was philosophically aligned with Keller. From 91 to 92, he had worked as a briefing attorney for the conservative CCA Judge Bill White, not the former Houston mayor and Democratic candidate for governor, who later became one of Keller's mentors. After a year of time working for White, he spent 20 years working in the appellate divisions of the DA's offices in Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio. The new judge quickly made public his position on actual innocence in the case of Sonia Casey, who had been wrongly convicted in 1993 of setting a fire in Fort Stockton that killed her uncle. In 2016, the CCA threw out her conviction and granted her actual innocence. While Urey thought that Casey deserved a new trial, he wrote a separate opinion, joined by Keller, that argued that the CCA should not go any further. "I would avoid the label of actual innocence," Urey wrote, "at least in the absence of evidence that conclusively proves not just that a reasonable jury by clear and convincing evidence would not have convicted her, but that the applicant manifestly did not commit the offense." The emphasis was Urey's, a sign of how strongly he felt the case he needed to literally prove she was innocent. Soon, Keller and Urey went even further. Texas had, over the previous 15 years, become one of the nation's standard bearers in legislative criminal justice reform. This was spurred by a series of exonerations in Dallas County, which awakened many Texans to the reality that a significant number of innocent people were stuck in prison. The laws that followed included new rules for eyewitness lineups and generous compensation packages for exonerees. A pioneering forensic science commission was established. In 2013, a groundbreaking law enabled inmates to use habeas writs to overturn convictions based on outdated or faulty forensic science. In 2018, the CCA used this law to grant actual innocence to Stephen Chaney, who spent 28 years in prison after being wrongly convicted of a Dallas murder based on since-discredited bite mark evidence. Taking a brief break here to remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on site and sound broadcasting. It's earmarked over 50 years and enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Radio since 1967, and we return to our text. Keller, though, used Cheney's case as an occasion to write a separate opinion in which she suggested raising the Elizondo bar of clear and convincing evidence to an almost unachievable height. Proof of innocence beyond a reasonable doubt. Urey wrote that he was intrigued by Keller's idea and open to a dialogue with my colleagues about that possibility in an appropriate case. The practical effect of what the two judges were suggesting was clear, making it essentially impossible for a wrongly convicted person to be declared actually innocent. Their peers, likewise conservative Republicans, were troubled by the idea and said so in their opinions. "That is too high a hurdle," wrote Judge Burt Richardson, noting that it would mean even the obviously innocent Chaney would be denied exoneration. In an unusually fraught exchange, he disparaged Urey's remarkable position. In the same opinion, Urey mocked some of his fellow judges for what he saw as their enthusiasm for financial reparations. "It is evident to me," he wrote, "that some members of this court relish being the arbiters of who is to receive monetary compensation and a lifetime of reduced-cost health care benefits." He wasn't the first to grumble about paying former inmates. During the CCA's weekly conferences, several judges, including Keller, have been known to suggest that compensation packages are a waste of taxpayer money. Other judges argued that no amount of money can repay someone for being wrongfully imprisoned by officials working in the public trust. The CCA received Grant's high-profile case in January, not long after Houston Police Chief Acevedo issued his public apology. To Grant and Ware, it seemed like a slam dunk. The court gets hundreds of cases a month, and a staff attorney typically works up a memo and gives it to whichever judge has been randomly assigned to the case. Many of the cases are quickly dismissed. Some are eventually discussed at the court's weekly conferences, and any judge who is interested in a case can pick it up and explore the possibility of writing an opinion. Most of the CCA's work is done out of public view, and its judges and staff lawyers decline requests to discuss Grant's case. We do know that at some point after the CCA received Grant's case, someone, either a staff attorney or a judge, noted that Carter's confession wasn't included in the case materials and thus suggested it be sent back to the trial court. This remand could have been ordered with or without discussion by the judges at their weekly conference. Either way, it takes a majority to order a remand. On April 1, a two-paragraph order was sent to Judge Powell's court in Houston. The confession was then submitted to the CCA on May 1st. By then, the judges and staff were working remotely because of the pandemic. Later that week, the state's court system was attacked by ransomware, and all servers were shut down. The Texas Appellate Management and E-Filing System, the TAEMS, was also shut down. The CCA insisted that the coronavirus has not affected the court's ability to deliberate on any case before it, and the ransomware did not compromise our data or case management systems. After additional security protocols were implemented, we continued working as usual. At some point thereafter, with the summer recess looming, Grant's case was brought up during a weekly conference. We don't know what was discussed, but on July 1st, the judges, except for David Newell, who recused himself because he had worked on Grant's appeal while working for the Harris County DA's office, remanded it again to the trial court. Most remands are two or three paragraphs long. This one took six paragraphs and was very detailed. It asked the trial court for any available photos of Carter from 2010, as well as affidavits from eyewitnesses in which they were to respond to Grant's actual innocence claim. It was a puzzling request. There were no details on what exactly the witnesses were supposed to respond to. For example, were they to give their opinion of the accuracy of the probabilistic genotyping, which had discerned the actual killer's DNA profile? The remand also ordered the trial court to reckon again with whether Grant had proven he was actually innocent or whether he was merely deserved a new trial. For Grant, this decision meant that while free on bond, he was still considered a convicted murderer and he was deprived of compensation. While the remand was possibly written by a staff attorney, it would have been overseen by a judge and approved by a majority of the tribunal. It's the voice of someone fighting actual innocence, says a veteran attorney who has argued numerous cases before the CCA. This order has Kevin Yeary all over it. The reaction was swift. Houston Chronicle called the move shameful. Ware said he had never seen anything like it. The trial judge, DA, and police chief, each of them says he's innocent. All of a sudden, the judges are ignoring DNA, questioning its validity as a science, and they want the trial court to get the witnesses to recant. It's the most outrageous thing I've ever seen. It makes no sense. The DNA scientist Ambers was flummoxed. I don't know what else Grant could do. It doesn't get any more definitive than that. As were prosecutors in the Harris County DA's office. They noted that the CCA's order made it harder to prosecute Carter, who, based on the new DNA evidence and his statements to police, they regard as actually guilty of the murder. Multiple former CCA judges were outraged. Lydell Grant has overwhelming evidence on his side, said Elsa Alcala, a judge on the court from 2011 to 2018. This is beyond reasonable doubt. This is beyond all doubt. There's no rational explanation for the court's action. Alcala acknowledged that the spring was a chaotic, terrible time for the court, but I don't cut the CCA any slack. The Texas Supreme Court cleared its docket. Kathy Cochran, who served on the CCA from 2001 to 2014 after working as both a prosecutor and a defense attorney, said, another remand further delays justice for the obviously innocent Lydell Grant, and it insults the diligence of the trial judge, the DA, and law enforcement in writing this. Other lawyers thought the court was being unfairly criticized. On the same day Grant's case was remanded, the court granted actual innocence to Otis Mallett Jr. Like Grant, Mallett was from Houston, and he also had the DA and trial judge firmly on his side. Yeary once again questioned the current standard. David Botsford, an Austin criminal defense lawyer for 42 years, said he had never seen a clearer case of actual innocence than Grant's. But he also noted the court has a duty to look at the record and make sure it's accurate. Botsford was a briefing attorney for the CCA in the 70s. When the state and defense are in agreement and the trial judge signs off, he said, it's not necessarily going to be rubber stamped by the CCA. A confession of error by the state is entitled to great weight, but it's not controlling. I don't fault the court for exercising its duty at all. And yet the end game, going back to the eyewitnesses, will ultimately be fruitless. What could they possibly say to change the picture, says Alcala. They got it wrong in the first place. All six of them could say, I still think he did it. And the court would have to say, eyewitness testimony is inconsequential when put up against DNA evidence. What upsets Alcala the most is that her former colleagues are guilty of a trap she occasionally fell into as well, deploying antiseptic legal logic while an actual human life is affected. Judges forget. People's lives are on hold. To us, it's a file, a piece of paper. To the person affected, he can't get a job. He was in prison for something he didn't do, and now he's still in prison, just a different kind. Alcala is certain that Keller and Yeary were behind the latest decision in the Grant case. Ware told me he worked on some 25 exonerations as a prosecutor with the Dallas County DA, many of them rape cases in which a man who had been misidentified by the victim was later exonerated by DNA. In all those rape cases, Ware says, the CCA never asked to go back and get statements from the eyewitnesses. Lydell's case is a DNA case, period. The objective facts are that Lydell Grant didn't do it, and we have the evidence that proves it. For some reason, that drives somebody on the CCA crazy. One reason might be the sheer volume of eyewitnesses. Perhaps the judges are curious as to how six of them could have gotten it so wrong. But even then, Laura Smallars, a professor at Arizona State University who's done extensive research on eyewitness lineups, said the CCA's decision is misguided. Smolarz noted that the police officer administering the lineups, Detective Cisneros, was also the lead investigator on the case, and that Grant was his only suspect. Though she couldn't pinpoint exactly why all six were mistaken, she said Grant's case was comparable to others she had studied. The most plausible explanation for why the eyewitnesses picked Grant is that the detective somehow cued the witnesses toward him. That could have happened because of the intentional or unintentional cueing. She calculated that the probability of six unbiased witnesses independently picking the same innocent man is roughly 0.00002, or 1 in 50,000. Smolarz attributed the witnesses' high level of confidence to Cisneros, who offered many of them positive feedback after their picks. Cisneros did not respond to requests for an interview. For example, three witnesses testified that the detective told them they had selected the same suspect chosen by others. Cisneros denied this at Grant's trial. He also told at least two of the witnesses, good job, after their picks. All of this confirmatory feedback, Smolarz wrote in an article she published on Grant's case in the academic news website, The Conversation, increases a person's confidence in their memory. Not only that, it can fundamentally change the original memory. As a result, the person these eyewitnesses see in their mind's eye today may not be the person they saw 10 years ago on that terrible night at Club Blur. For all these reasons, she concluded, there is little to be gained from speaking to the original eyewitnesses from Lydell Grant's case. One sweltering day in late July, Grant sat on the outside patio of a Starbucks near the Galleria in Houston, sipping a mocha frappuccino with extra whip and drizzle. Grant is now 43, a big man at 6'2", 240 pounds. He wore black Ralph Lauren shorts and a red t-shirt, Adidas sneakers, a black COVID-19 mask, and two gold chains, one with a Bart Simpson pendant, the other with a unicorn head. After finishing a piece of lemon cake, he pointed out his haircut, short on top, shaved on the sides. It's known as the South Side, he said with a wide grin. People from Houston, we invented this. Grant has a boyish laugh and a wide, expressive face. When he smiles, deep dimples form in his cheeks. He speaks rapidly, enthusiastically. He's outgoing and friendly, even with a mask on, constantly striking up conversations with complete strangers. He lives with his mother, Donna Poe, who's now 64 and works at a cashier at HEB in her two-story brick home in the Berkshire neighborhood of Northwest Houston. He spends most of his time there, drafting letters to friends still in prison and working on a memoir titled, Where Did I Go Wrong? He's also taking online courses at American Intercontinental University. He still studies law, only now he's focused on the section of the criminal code that governs habeas writs. He's struggled to find work. I'm stuck, he said. I have a lot of love and support, but I can't get a job. Since his release last December, he's applied for several positions at warehouses and grocery stores, and he's landed several interviews, but always falls apart after they see the murder conviction on his criminal background check. It's embarrassing, he said. He checks in every week with his bail bondsman. He knows that one misstep could land him in severe trouble. When he does go out, sometimes it's to drive his red 2007 Kia Optima to local churches, including New South Main Baptist, where he addresses groups of kids who remind him a lot of himself. He tries to inspire them with his story, going from youthful troublemaker to convicted robber to a man wrongfully convicted of murder to an entirely new life. My yesteryears don't define me, he tells them. They contributed to me becoming who I am today. I experienced that so I could move on with my life. But Grant's optimism has limits. He's plagued by severe pain in his neck and back, brought on by years in prison, sleeping on concrete and steel. He can't afford to go to a doctor for treatment. He's also tormented by despair. Just as he is quick to smile and joke, he's also prone to outbursts of anger. It's common for exonerees to have trouble with bitterness after having years of their lives stolen. Grant's feelings are compounded by the fact that he is still legally considered a killer even after new DNA evidence pointed to the actual murderer. He suspects that his race is part of the reason his case has languished, a belief shared by Ware. Not long after the CCA remanded in Grant's case, Ware penned an op-ed for the Houston Chronicle entitled, Yes, Racism is Systemic. Ask Lydell Grant, an innocent black man the courts haven't gotten around to exonerating. Ware wrote, unfortunately, this sort of unexplained and unjustified delay in exonerating an obviously innocent man is not unusual. Systemic racism pervades the entire criminal justice system, from the street cop to the judiciary. A 2017 study by the National Registry of Exonerations found that blacks were 7 times more likely than whites to be wrongly convicted of murder, and that they have to wait 3 years longer to be exonerated. Donna thinks her son's multiple arrests and convictions before his murder case are another factor in the way the CCA is treating him today. Perhaps the judges are more skeptical of his innocence or reserve less empathy for him because of his criminal record. As a mother, she's infuriated by this. Her son paid for his previous sins, and to continue to punish him for something he says he didn't do is cruel and arbitrary, she says. I don't understand it. He proved his innocence. What more do they need? Both Donna and Alonzo Poe fear Grant suffers from PTSD from his time in prison. She says the rattle of keys and the flash of lights can cause him to fly off the handle. One night, she walked into her kitchen and flipped on the light. Grant was there, sitting in the dark, and he began yelling, "Mama, I told you I don't need the light on!" The CCA initially gave the trial court until September 30 to complete its request, but by that date, the DA's office was only able to gather one eyewitness affidavit. So prosecutors asked for an extension. They now have until January 25th. Once the CCA finally gets all the documents in order, there's no guarantee it will bestow actual innocence on Grant. In fact, some fear the court is primed to merely grant him a new trial. That, says former CCA Judge Cochran, would be a legally disingenuous and morally indefensible end run around his actual innocence claim. Still, she's hopeful that her ex-colleagues will ultimately do the right thing. I am confident that the court will not shirk its duty or set aside the trial judges and prosecution's findings and recommendations. In spite of all his experiences, Grant remains upbeat, certain the CCA will exonerate him. He has thought often about the compensation, part of which he plans to use to buy a truck and a trailer and start a trash hauling business. I love trucks. All my buddies at the chemical plants had trucks. He also still hopes for a music career. Recently, Grant began writing new songs for the first time since 2010, though his subject matter has transformed. One new song, "They Don't Like Me Now," is about the false friends who mocked him when he went to prison for murder but cheered him when he was released. Another is "Mama's Love," about the person who never doubted him. But one song he thinks could actually be a hit is a rap he wrote soon after being released. He just had dinner at his brother Alonzo's house, and he was sitting at the dining room table when he began spontaneously humming a beat. He found himself singing the words, "I'm not guilty." That phrase wasn't exactly right, though. He revised it and began repeating a new line, almost like a mantra. Soon, a melody arose. He turned a new phrase over in his mind and then pulled out a pen and paper as more words came to him. The lyrics captured the story of his life, from arrest to trial to prison to freedom. Some of the lines he conjured were philosophical. "Whatever's done in the dark, it shall surface." Others were inspirational. "Never give up." Still others revealed Grant's love of rhyme and wordplay. "I don't need the stress," he wrote. "I'm like, what's next? Mike Ware and the Innocence Project." Grant sat at the table for hours, toying with rhymes, writing, rewriting, remembering. Just before sunrise, he finished. Heading off to bed, he ran through the song one more time. 3 long verses and a melodic chorus that was as simple and true as you could possibly make it. "I'm actually innocent," sang Lydell Grant, "because I didn't do it." Next up, we turn back to the state. It's a front part of the magazine. This is Traveling Outdoors. It's Excursions by Pamela Blanc. It's cold water therapy. Winter kayaking and canoeing are catching on even among heat-loving Texans. Before dawn on a cold January morning in 2014, Veronica Sosa, a relative newcomer to long-distance canoeing, set out with a teammate on a 62-mile paddle race down the Colorado River. The temperature hovered in the upper teens, and almost immediately after Sosa launched from beneath the Interstate 35 bridge on Austin's Lady Bird Lake, she started shivering in her seat. She was still shaking about an hour into the race when she and her partner sloshed through ankle-deep water and dragged her canoe up a bank and around a small dam. It felt like a selfie moment, so Sosa snapped a picture with her phone, and that's when she noticed it. "Oh my God, is there ice in my hair?" Sosa recalls asking her teammate, who confirmed that, yes, her braids were covered in caterpillar-sized icicles. At the next checkpoint, 16 miles downstream, the wife of another paddler took one look at Sosa and tossed her the fleece jacket off her back and handed her a styrofoam cup of hot cocoa. Still, Sosa never fully thawed. For more than 12 hours, from the start of the Texas Winter 100K race on Lady Bird Lake to the end at Bastrop's Fisherman's Park, Sosa experienced what outdoor types call Type 2 fun. On the so-called fun scale, Type 1 fun is enjoyable in the moment fun. Type 3 is awful to experience and to recall, not really fun at all. Type 2 is miserable at the time, but remembered fondly later. As Sosa discovered, cold weather paddling in Texas is a different kind of adventure than a fair weather excursion. A summer paddle offers a chance to spot turtles sunbathing on rocks and hear riverside trees rustling in the wind. It's also a fully immersive experience. If the sweat starts to trickle, kayakers and canoers can just flop into the water for relief. But starting in fall, bodies of water from the Red River to the Rio Grande shake off their cloaks of green leaves and water temperatures drop. Few paddlers are tempted to take a flying leap into the water, but there are other rewards. Physical exertion in the cold as a way of clearing away mental and physical cobwebs. The outline of the landscape comes into focus behind the barren trees, and birds stand out against the stark backdrop. The water settles and clears. The tubers with their beer-packed coolers and loud music stay home. A sense of calm settles over the water, and paddlers can focus on the surrounding beauty and serenity. A quick sidebar here. Breaking records. The course record for the Texas Winter 100K was set in 2019 when Will Leeds of San Marcos finished in 6 hours and 46 minutes, thanks in part to fast-moving water. Back to our text. My first cold weather paddle was 2 years ago when I decided against my better judgment to train for the Texas Water Safari, an annual 260-mile sufferfest down the San Marcos and Guadalupe Rivers to the Texas coast. The race, which takes place in June, is notoriously sweaty, but to be competitive, you must start practicing in the dead of winter, which is why I was on a group training run in the middle of January. Our canoe approached a low-water bridge, and my four-person team had to jump out of the boat to get around the obstacle. I misjudged the landing and found myself in neck-deep water, bobbing like a pool toy. Luckily, I was prepared, thanks to some sage advice from my mentors, including Holly Orr, a veteran endurance canoe racer, who helps train athletes for the Safari through Paddle with Style, a company she owns in Martindale, southeast of San Marcos. Orr urges her paddlers to bring a waterproof bag with a change of clothing, a few hand warmers, and one of those silvery space blankets. Shivering on the muddy bank, I stripped off the wet stuff, tugged on the fresh duds, and put my paddle back into water. Always be prepared to be fully submerged, Orr says. Wear layers, she and other experts advise. Tights and a top made of wicking fabric, a fleece and a windbreaker or waterproof paddling jacket, as well as a hat, and peel things off as you warm up. It's also important to stay hydrated, which isn't as intuitive when the water isn't the temperature of a hot bath. Conditions at the Texas Winter 100K have ranged from bone-chilling to balmy over the years. From the get-go, we expected harsh conditions, and the first year was the worst, says race director Wes Hansen, a longtime endurance racer from Austin. That first year, 2011, paddlers were pelted by sleet, and a wayward golden retriever hitched a ride on a stranger's boat before being reunited with its owner downstream. After my first brisk indoctrination with chilly temperatures, I've made a habit of paddling in the winter every few weeks, even on dank, blustery days. The world might look bleak, but I've come to feel a kind of kinship with Arctic seals, which frolic on the ice for the pure joy of it. Of course, it's always more fun to freeze with friends who share your warped sense of entertainment. Which is why the Dallas Downriver Club organizes roughly a dozen camping trips a year, all of them between October and June. The club's members like to take advantage of the improved clarity of typically murky North and East Texas waterways. In colder months, mold and algae die off and the water smells and looks less funky. The year's schedule includes a polar paddle at Caddo Lake in January and a trip down the Sabine River near Carthage in February. Most of us just don't like the oppressive heat, sun beating on you when it's 100 degrees outside, says Dale Harris, the president of the club. You can only take so many clothes off, but you can always put more clothes on. Harris also oversees the Trinity River Paddling Trail, the 130-mile stretch of the Trinity and its tributaries in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Paddlers can launch their boats from any of 21 official put-in sites. Other streams across the state, from remote Devils and Pecos Rivers in West Texas to the Brazos River in North and Central Texas to Buffalo Bayou in downtown Houston, offer great opportunities to get on the water, too. And for those who prefer more placid paddling, Texas is home to plenty of suitable flatwater options. From North Texas offerings such as White Rock Lake, Lake Arlington, Grapevine Lake, and Lake Louisville, to the Houston area's Lake Conroe and Clear Lake. As for Sosa, he's warmed up, mostly to the idea of winter paddling. After skipping the Texas Winter 100K for a few years after the icicle incident, she entered the race again in 2018, 2019, and 2020, and will compete again this year if it's not too chilly. I can paddle in hell, probably, but not when I have ice on me, he says. It took a couple of years to really get the gumption to do it again because I am a Texas girl at heart. This year, the 100K, which includes categories for recreational paddlers as well as competitive athletes, is scheduled for January 23rd. Hansen, the race organizer, has paddled all the Texas coast as well as the Amazon and Volga rivers. For his next adventure, He's planning the ultimate in cold water trips. In September 2021, he and two other Texans are set to kayak 1,900 miles through the Northwest Passage in the Arctic. Average water temperature, 30 degrees. Pam LeBlanc, who wrote this, is an Austin-based journalist who specializes in outdoor adventure and recreation. And that brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturdays at 5 and Mondays at 2, on Sight into Sound Broadcast.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
Need help? Know someone who does? If you or someone you care about are feeling overwhelmed with emotions like sadness, depression, or anxiety, or you feel like you want to harm yourself or others, call 911. Call the Disaster Distress Helpline at 800-985-5900 or call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233.
We begin our first book of the new year with What Unites Us by Dan Rather, now airing on the Noon Book Hour. The former CBS anchor says, I find myself thinking deeply about what it means to love America, as I surely do. At a moment of crisis over our national identity, Rather is reflecting on what it means to be an American. Now with this collection of original essays, he reminds us of the principles upon which the United States was founded, looking at the freedoms that define us, from the vote to the press, the values that have transformed us, from empathy to inclusion to service, the institutions that sustain us, such as public education, and the traits that helped form our young country, such as taking on daunting challenges in medicine and science. As a living witness to historical change, he offers up an intimate view of history, tracing where we have been in order to help us chart a way forward and heal our bitter divisions. With a fundamental sense of hope, What Unites Us is the book to inspire conversation and listening, and to remind us all how we are finally one. What Unites Us by Dan Rather, weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 56 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and the Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading the latest articles that can be found on Texas Highways website at texashighways.com. And the first article is titled Yellowstone Creator Taylor Sheridan Learned to Cowboy in Small Town Cranfield's Gap. The Paramount Network hit was inspired by the Sheridan Family Ranch by Michael Corcoran. There's no shortage of rattlesnakes in Boss County, says Taylor Sheridan, co-creator of Yellowstone, the highest-rated cable TV show of 2020. I don't know how I never got bit. Now I've got to find wood to knock on because we've got a scene with some rattlesnakes tomorrow. Yellowstone is set on a Montana ranch that's the size of Rhode Island, according to the show's ruthless patriarch, John Dutton, played by Kevin Costner. But the roots of the gripping contemporary Western can be traced to a 214-acre ranch near the town of Cranfield's Gap, 54 miles west of Waco. That's where Sheridan, who writes and directs the series, learned to ride horses, shoot guns, and make movies in his head. He named his production company Bosky Ranch to honor where he comes from. I'm deeply influenced by where I grew up and how I grew up, says Sheridan, speaking by phone from the set in Montana. In addition to Yellowstone, Sheridan is also responsible for the creation of the neo-Western film trilogy of Sicario, 2015, Hell or High Water, 2016, and Wind River, 2017, a run that led Esquire to declare him our generation's greatest Western storyteller in 2018. We didn't depend on our ranch for income, says Sheridan, whose father was a cardiologist in Fort Worth. But it's where I learned how to become a cowboy. Sheridan's first job, at 14, was working on a cattle ranch a few miles outside of Cranfield's Gap for $400 a month and a bunk. His mother, Susan Drew, grew up in Waco, and her sanctuary was her grandparents' ranch near the Boskyville neighborhood. She wanted her children to similarly, quote, have an opportunity to learn firsthand about the peaceful feeling of freedom in nature, she says. The family bought the Cranfield's Gap Ranch in 1978. When Sheridan was 8, they would drive the 85 miles south from Fort Worth for weekends, holidays, and summers. Back then, the Gap had a hardware store, a grocery store, a feed store, and a fill-in station, Sheridan recalls. And that's about it. We were pretty isolated on the ranch. We'd get excited when the propane man would come to fill the tank. The family spread was part of our Norwegian settlement, comprising the family's 1870s stone house, which is listed in the National Register of Historic Places, and 14 other 19th century homes built on a ridge above Little Norway, the Gap, and the surrounding area. The ranch is a couple miles up a dirt road from the area's most popular tourist attraction, St. Olaf's Kirk, better known as the Rock Church, for its intricate stone masonry. Built by Norwegian immigrants in 1886, the landmark was beautifully restored in 2010 and is open to the public. The church was a place of mischief for Sheridan when he was about 12 or 13. Me and a couple friends liked to sneak upstairs to the organ and wait for visitors. When someone came in, I'd wait a minute and then play a really dramatic chord, he says, laughing at the memory of tourists running out of the, quote, haunted church. When told there's now a locked gate protecting the organ, Sheridan says, that's probably because of us. Multiple Native American tribes predated the Norwegians in the Gap, and the 1970 discovery of a Paleo-Indian burial site in Bosque County made the area a focus for archaeologists. "We always had folks from the University of Texas digging around on the ranch," says Sheridan, who found not only Native American arrowheads and tools, but also a loaded 1800s pistol. The artifacts fueled Taylor's imagination, as did local lore. In 1867, Comanches in the historic upper settlement of the Gap kidnapped 14-year-old Ole Nystel and held him for 3 months. "We all knew that story," says Sheridan, whose interest in Native Americans is found in several of his screenplays, especially his directorial debut, Wind River, a crime story set on a reservation in Wyoming. The Viking Theater on 3rd Street hasn't shown a movie in more than half a century, but the Norwegian influence is still felt in the Gap, population 281. The old weighing station for wool and mohair is still where it was in the 1970s when the fields were full of Angora goats, but today the scale is a display piece inside the Horny Toad Bar and Grill, a former feed store. The place is famous for its chicken quesadillas, not lutefisk and boiled potatoes, the traditional dish served at the Cranfield's Gap School cafeteria on the first Saturday in December, in conjunction with Bosque County's Norwegian Country Christmas. During his high school years in the late 80s, Sheridan lived a dual identity that would merge in his adult life. He was that rare weekend wrangler who was also a theater kid, playing Kanicki in Greece and at Paschal High in Fort Worth. At 16, he auditioned for Piaf with Cowtown's well-regarded Stage West Theater and got a part. "The play was held over, and I had to miss a school dance," he says, "but I was getting paid to act." When the weather's nice, the Horny Toad Bar and Grill in Cranfield's Gap is a favorite stop for motorcycle enthusiasts. On a Saturday in late September, 3rd Street was so full of bikers, the Sheridan credit that came to mind was Sons of Anarchy. In 2008, Sheridan landed his first big acting role in Hollywood, playing the no-nonsense deputy police chief in the hit series about an outlaw motorcycle gang. But when he asked for a raise after 2 seasons, the writers killed him off. It wasn't long, however, before Sheridan was doing the killing off. He took to screenwriting in his early 40s because he wanted to come home and tell stories about his heritage on his own terms. "I'd read so many bad scripts as an actor," he says. "I knew what not to do." He mined his Texas youth for the diner scene in Hell or High Water, which stars Jeff Bridges. A surly waitress takes an order from Bridges and his partner by asking, "What don't you want?" It was a fixed menu place where the only decision was to not have the corn or not have the green beans. "That actually happened to me and my father when we ate at a West Texas diner when I was about 19, Sheridan says, almost word for word. The Bridges character was inspired by Sheridan's cousin, Parnell McNamara, a retired deputy U.S. Marshal who was recently re-elected McLennan County Sheriff. "Taylor showed an interest in law enforcement growing up," McNamara says, "but he was just born for that ranch. He was really upset when his mom sold it." Sheridan's screenplay for Hell or High Water, about a pair of brothers taking desperate measures to save their family's West Texas farm, was nominated for an Oscar. Holding on to your land is a perennial Sheridan theme. "When you write, it's always of an autobiographical nature," he says. "Our family ranch has informed Yellowstone in many ways, but losing it was the biggest one." While TV's Dutton family turns to violence and intimidation to hold onto its territory, Sheridan's family ranch was sold in 1991 after his parents divorced, while he was at Texas State University in San Marcos. "I don't think Taylor spoke to me for a year," says his mother, who had decided she couldn't run the ranch alone. Sheridan thinks about the feelings attached to his family's old spread when he writes episodes for the show he pitched to Paramount as, quote, "the godfather on the biggest ranch in the country." Yellowstone is high drama in Big Sky Country, an addictive rope opera reminiscent of Dallas. But the show also hits home with those raised in rural communities because of its authenticity. Sheridan remains an avid equestrian who'd rather go to horse shows and rodeos than the movies. His wife, Nicole Muirbrook,